You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 8th. I'm Candace Carr from Drake University. Here is our first story. Hope for Hemp, Lincoln Area Farm Trying to Reshape Nebraska Agriculture. After their half-acre test plot started drawing too much attention, they could hear cars slowing down on the gravel road and then stopping. The family farmers put up a sign, "This is not marijuana." They didn't blame drivers for their confusion. A year ago, and for about 15 years before that, the patch of land along Northwest 27th Street, a couple minutes north of the Kawasaki plant in Northwest Lincoln, had been planted in brome grass. But as this summer unfolded, the plot appeared to be packed with a pot, a thick, lush crop standing taller than a man, its distinctive seven-pointed leaves drawing double takes. Quote, "We had lots and lots of people looking at it," said Rosemary Reed, one of the farmer's co-owners, "and lots of people stopping." Their sign elaborated, "This is industrial hemp." It was more than that. That half acre by the road and a similarly sized plot behind it represented a grand experiment. Can a fifth generation, 310-acre farm long dependent on corn and soybeans, like so many other Nebraska farms, change directions and pursue what its owners see as an environmentally friendlier and more sustainable future? Can it say goodbye to four digits anhydrous ammonia bills and the need for pesticides and the volatility of commodity prices? "It's trying," said Alice Reed, another co-owner. Quote, "That's what we're working toward. We're trying to come up with something we can plant that will make us money and that isn't harmful to the soil. Let's make the planet a healthier place. Let's grow a crop that is useful to people and not just used for cow feed and gasoline." The farmer's daughters grew up on Stratford Avenue in Lincoln's Country Club neighborhood. Quote, "My mother was adamant. She wanted her girls to be city girls," Rosemary Reed said. Quote, "So my dad would commute and do farm work with our grandfather." Their father had been born on the farm northwest of Lincoln, and before he died in 2001, he gave it to his daughters. They weren't ready to be farmers. Yet. Rosemary Reed left Lincoln to work as a teacher at several schools in the Southwest, and ended up as a news reporter at an Oregon rock music station, transitioned to TV, and landed at WTTG in Washington, D.C., creating and producing its hour-long weekend news installments, and working with a younger Maury Povich. The entire news staff lost their jobs when Rupert Murdoch bought the station. So, in 1987, Rosemary Reed started her own production company, creating corporate and small business videos, documentaries, and public service announcements. Quote, "It grows like a weed," quote, Alice Reed said. "It's a great crop for Nebraska. We thought it would be a great thing for the future of farming." They traced their belief to their father, she said. He knew its value. He'd show his daughters a pile of ditchweed and say, quote, "This is what they grew for rope." That would stick with them, though at the time, they might have been tempted by its telltale leaves. Quote, "We learned quickly that wasn't the way to do it," she said. "It's very harsh. Hemp fiber could strengthen more than rope. Manufacturers could use it for fabric, canvas, car upholstery, shoes, paper, and other products. But they had it imported from other countries because United States farmers were forbidden from growing it." So more than 20 years ago, Rosemary and Alice Reed tried to lobby lawmakers in Washington, pushing for the legalization of hemp production. They couldn't get an audience with any members of Nebraska's congressional delegation, though they did get time with Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. Quote, "It had been a little bee in my bonnet for a while. Let's make this farm a little more diverse. And we think hemp is quite diverse," Rosemary Reed said. "We just didn't have the means to do it." A few things had to happen first. Lawmakers had to realize you can't get high on low THC hemp. And in 2018, the United States Farm Bill legalized the plant, striking it from the Drug Enforcement Agency's list of controlled substances and opening the door for a 2019 Nebraska law allowing regulated production. In the next year, a pandemic had to rearrange the world and its work habits for Rosemary Reed to wonder why. Why was she still running her production company from Washington? She could run it from anywhere. Quote, "I thought, why am I leasing a very expensive space when my staff is scattered to the winds? I said goodbye to my lease, and I moved to Lincoln to help get things going." Dakota Zirk didn't know what to expect from the two half-acre test plots. Alice Reed's son had worked for a flower distributor, ran a landscaping crew, and had graduated with honors with a horticultural degree from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. But he'd never grown hemp. He talked to others in the industry and chose two types of fiber-forward seeds, one for each plot. He plowed, tilled, tested the soil, added compost, and, in May, planted 50 pounds of seed at each site. And then he waited. Quote, "I was like, I hope this works. I was kind of watching the field daily, just making sure something was going to pop up." Watching the field was about all he had to do as the summer unfolded. He didn't need to water the hemp or fertilize it or weed it. The stalks grew so dense they allowed no room for neighbors. Quote, "We didn't do anything after I planted it until we had to cut it down." By July, he could see ribbing on the stalks, a sign the fiber was building, and the pollen sacs were opening. They were ready for their first hemp harvest. But first, they had to test its THC levels to make sure it was impotent. State law prohibits the plant from having more than 0.3%, and there's no margin for error. In 2020, 27 of 150 samples failed the test, and the state destroyed more than 24 acres. This year's failure figures won't be released until after January 1st. Reed's Green Growers' first hemp attempt passed the test, and they hired a farmer from Malcolm to help with the harvest. Rosemary Reed also hired a film crew. In early August, with cameras recording from the ground and a drone hovering above, Jared Uecker climbed onto his 1964 Massey Ferguson Super 90. He lowered his sickle bar and dropped the crop in less than 15 minutes. Quote, "Doesn't feel like much to me," he said after. Quote, "But it's a lot to us," Rosemary Reed said. They wouldn't know how much or how little for at least two more months. They never intended to make money with their first hemp harvest. On a self-serving level, it was a test, an experiment, to see if they could do it, to learn how to do it better, and try to reinvent their farm. The neighbor who worked their land gets 60% of the crop's proceeds, and the Reed's family remaining 40% barely covers its property taxes, Alice Reed said. At the time, she'd just finished paying their anhydrous bill, more than $6,000. Quote, "That's a lot of money to be putting on something you don't make anything back on. We're trying to come up with something we can plant that will make us more money and that isn't harmful to the soil." They know they can't replace the state's traditional crops, but what if they devoted 100 acres, a third of their land, to hemp? What if others did the same thing? Quote, "And that would be the hope," Rosemary Reed said. "That's what local farmers do. They're not going to replace corn and soybeans. We know that. That would help their broader goal, to show other farmers hemp is a viable and to have enough harvested hemp to justify opening a processing plant." That would solve the catch-22. Farmers are reluctant to supply hemp until there's a processing plant to sell it to. But until there's enough supply, a processing plant is cost prohibitive. The pros, their farm is on a rail line, close to highways and zone agricultural commercial, Rosemary Reed said. The con, they don't have the $3 to $5 million needed for a building and equipment, and they don't have other farmers ready to commit their crops. Quote, "It's a chicken and egg thing. Do you build a processing plant first and just hope they will come with product?" It worked for a fourth-generation farm near Great Bend, Kansas. It started adding hemp to its crop rotation in 2019. A good learning year, but not a great production year, said co-owner Melissa Nelson. And then it had a good crop in 2020, but the buyer bailed. Quote, "We were like, we've got farmers that say they would grow if they had a place to take it, and we've got manufacturers reaching out to us asking where we're taking our hemp to get processed because they want it." South Bend Industrial Hemp bridged the gap this year, opening a processing plant with 1,600 acres under contract, including 1 acre from Reed's Green Growers. They left the plants on the ground for 2 weeks, a process called redding, letting time and moisture and microorganisms help separate the fiber from the stalk. A nearby farmer scooped it all up, leaving them with 4 large round bales and a smaller fifth, the future of their farm, all bundled up. But they would have to wait nearly 2 more months to see what kind of grade their test crop would earn. Finally, in mid-October, after hiring someone to load the bales on a flatbed and haul them more than 250 miles to the processing plant in Kansas. The family learned the results. Just less than 500 for an acre of hemp, less than the farm grosses on an acre of corn. Quote, "This year's harvest was an experiment," Rosemary Reed. "And we did not expect to make any money. And we didn't. I mean, sadly, we didn't. In fact, they spent about $500 on the seed itself. But Zerk, the farm manager, realizes now he overseeded and could have probably put half as much down for the same result. And if the farm scales up and plants more acres, he could cut its cost per pound seed prices by buying in bulk. And to make this first crop possible, they paid others for the cutting, baling, and shipping. But if they could just grow enough to justify buying their own equipment, and if they had their own processing plant nearby, those contracted costs would disappear," Rosemary Reed said. So they're moving forward. They plan to try again next year and plant at least another acre, maybe more. They need to negotiate with their sharecropper, she said. Quote, "He's going to have to be convinced that we can make some profit if we take 20 acres out of the corn and soybeans and put it into hemp. Just like they have to convince other farmers to replace some of their bread and butter crops with hemp to help make their family's plan and their plant possible. But they're prepared." Quote, "It's a selling job," Rosemary Reed said. "That's what we're doing right now. We're selling a concept." Lewis Central High School to hold public Veterans Day Assembly. Lewis Central High School will hold its Veterans Day Assembly Thursday to honor veterans, fallen service members. It marks the return of the annual event, which was canceled last year because of the pandemic. The ceremony will run from 9:45 to 10:30 a.m., Thursday, November 11th. Veterans Day, originally called Armistice Day, is held on November 11th each year because the agreement ended that ended World War I, then known as the, quote, "War to End All Wars," took effect on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918. The colors will be presented by Abraham Lincoln High School Air Force Junior ROTC Unit, Iowa 951, and the national anthem will be performed by the LCHS Chamber Choir. LCHS staff who have served and family members of staff and students who have served will be recognized, as well as local recruiters. LCHS seniors who have committed to serve and local veteran organizations. Lou Perivel, LCHS success counselor and MC of the ceremony, will speak about being the daughter of a World War II veteran, and two students will offer tributes to their fathers who have served. Another student will read an essay they wrote on what it means to be an American. The LCHS Chamber Choir, and band will perform other patriotic music. The event is free and open to the public. St. Albert High School opens doors to Army of Robots. St. Albert High School will be invaded by an army of robots today as it hosts a first Tech Challenge robotics meet. It's the first meet of the season for the school's team, Thunderstruck, and the fifth year the school has hosted a meet. It was not held last year, according to Coach Andrea Barnes, who shares volunteer coaching duties with Lynn Gardner. Quote, "We're ready for tomorrow, as long as the robot doesn't quit," she said Friday. However, since last year's meets were virtual, it will be a new experience for the younger members of the team, Barnes said. Quote, "The in-person thing is where you really get to know the kids on the other teams." 15 other teams from 8 other schools registered for the meet, with Creighton Prep, Marion, and Shenandoah High Schools each fielding multiple teams. Abraham Lincoln High School's RoboStorm signed up, as well as Jurassic Spark from Creston, TechBam, Villisca, and Diagonal Hotspots from where else? Diagonal. However, Barnes expects only 10 to 12 teams to compete, as this year's challenge, quote, "Freight Frenzy," was released later than usual. Quote, "Not everybody is ready yet." Teams have to build and program their robots, and drivers need to practice the maneuvers they will use during meets. All Thunderstruck members take turns driving, Barnes said. The meet begins with inspections, field tests, and random pairings for alliances, she said. Competition will begin at about 12:30 p.m., and each team usually has 6 matches. An alliance is made up of 2 players from different teams, Barnes said. Quote, "Your alliance partner from one match could be your opponent in the next match. In the robotics world, they would call that cooperation." The challenge is done on a 12-square-foot field with two large rectangles that represent warehouses for the freight and two squares that are storage areas for the two opposing alliances, according to a, quote, freight frenzy video. There are three multi-level circular shipping hubs in the central area, one for each alliance and one shared, and small carousels in two corners. The freight includes 60 cube-shaped boxes of different weights and a flock of rubber ducks. During the 30-second autonomous period, the pre-programmed robot, without a human operator, will try to score points by moving freight to the warehouse hub or alliance storage unit using a team scoring element or rubber duck to detect the shipping hub level and or parking in a warehouse or alliance storage unit. Alliances can score points during the 2-minute driver controlled period by putting freight in the alliance hub. The higher the tier, the better. The shared hub or the alliance storage unit. During the end game, the last 30 seconds, players can score by tipping the shared hub toward their alliance, capping the alliance hub, balancing the alliance hub, delivering a duck or team shipping element via carousel, and parking in a warehouse. Barnes is feeling good about this season, with 9 students on the team. Quote, "That's pretty good, considering we didn't have any middle school teams last year." It's the 6th year for St. Albert's robotics program, which began at the middle school level, Barnes said. A dentist by profession, she got involved the first year. Quote, "I started doing this because my middle daughter didn't have a coach." The team's next meet will be on December 4th at Velisica. Boswell receives life sentence for Louvre slaying. The story is headlined by a photo of Bailey Boswell crying after viewing a recorded video interview of her adopted father during Boswell's sentence hearing on Thursday in Saline County District Court. In Wilbur, Bailey Boswell will not be the first woman in Nebraska to receive a death sentence. Instead, she will be sentenced to life in prison without parole, a punishment announced at the Saline County Courthouse on Monday morning for her role in the 2017 murder and dismemberment of Sidney Louvre. Though Judge Vicki Johnson laid out the case why a majority of the 3-judge panel believe the state had successfully proved the, quote, exceptional depravity exhibited by Boswell and her co-conspirator, Aubrey Traill, the judges weren't in unanimous agreement, hence the sentence of life in prison. This is a developing story. The original story below will be updated throughout the day. Bailey Boswell is set to learn here today whether she will be sentenced to death row for the killing and dismemberment of a Lincoln woman she lured to her death in 2017 under the guise of a date after meeting online. If she is, Boswell will be the first woman in Nebraska to get the ultimate penalty. Sidney Louvre's disappearance, November 15, 2017, led to a multi-state manhunt for Boswell and Aubrey Traill, who in Facebook videos claimed to know nothing about it. Their cell phone records later led investigators to fields and ditches in Clay County, where they made the grisly discovery of her remains left scattered in trash bags. Separate juries later found Traill, 55, and Boswell, 27, guilty of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder for luring Louvre to their Wilbur apartment where they killed and dismembered her body. In June, Traill was sentenced to death row. At a hearing a month later, Saline County District Judge Vicki Johnson, Douglas County District Judge Peter Battalion, and Lancaster County District Judge Darla Ideas heard aggravating and mitigating evidence in Boswell's case, where prosecutors alleged the killing of Sidney Louvre showed, quote, exceptional depravity, as outlined in state law. And the defense sought to explain how Boswell, a high school star athlete in Leon, Iowa, and small-town girl before she left college, had ended up with Traill, a con man twice her age, and involved in a killing. Assistant Attorney General Doug Warner pointed to planning that Boswell was part of, including steps to conceal her identity when she posted Tinder profiles, and to a medium-sized sauna suit with a crotch out and a boxed sex toy found dumped near the remains as proof the couple had carried out a sexual fantasy they told other women about in the months before the killing. Warner also pointed to the more than necessary number of cuts to dismember Louvre's body and superficial cut marks around the tattoo on her arm that said, quote, "Everything will be wonderful someday," as signs that Boswell and Traill relished the crime. At the hearing, Boswell told the 3-judge panel she was sorry for everything that happened to Loof, quote, and for my role in what happened to her, and pleaded with the judges not to take her life for her young daughter's sake. Quote, I believed he really loved me, she said of Trail, who gave her gifts and money. Later, I was afraid of him. Dr. Kirk Newring, a psychologist hired by the defense, said Boswell had turned to alcohol and drugs to deal with emotional abuse and verbal berating by a college coach, had been sexually assaulted in college and made to believe it was her fault, and then suffered beatings and sexual punishments by her boyfriend, a football player who had seemed charming at first and later trafficked her on Backpack, a website that advertised commercial sex acts, which is how Trail found Boswell. Newring described their relationship as a, quote, trauma bond, where Boswell quickly became reliant on Trail for everything. At a trial in October 2020, a jury found Boswell guilty of first-degree murder, conspiracy, and the unlawful disposal of remains. Trail was found guilty at a trial in 2019 and on June 9th was sentenced to death by a separate 3-judge panel. Prosecutors said the two worked together to recruit young women in a conspiracy to kill and ultimately choose Loof as their victim, and that Boswell lured her into the Wilbur apartment the night of November 15, 2017, under the guise of a date after matching on Tinder. The article is then concluded with a compilation of courtroom photos from October 14, October 9, September 25, and June 18. These photos include tense individuals discussing the litigation matters behind this brutal murder case. These individuals including an FBI agent, local prosecutors, and Judge Vicki Johnson on the bench, clad in her black district court robe and hanging pearl collar, similar to the likes of the late Supreme Court Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg. There are also photos of letters written by Aubrey Trail, documented in pencil on wide ruled notebook paper filled with smiley faces and cryptic codes for his victims. Solas shelter almost full, many cats available. This story is headlined by a small, green-eyed black cat staring curiously at a bright orange pumpkin. Hello from Solas, and welcome to the next chapter of, quote, Cats, Cats, Kittens. For this week, a reminder, Solas is hosting our very first online auction starting November 28th and running through December 19th. Stay tuned for more details. Thank you to everyone who donated items that will appear in this auction. Next, we want to have a talk about animals and adoption. Did you know this has been a crazy year for animals? Somewhat probably due to Mother Nature and somewhat due to people adopting during COVID-19, then changing their minds months later. This has been a wild spring, summer, and now fall. Solas, along with almost every shelter in the area, is staying almost completely full. So, can you help the animals out by making room for another furry family member in your life? As an example, we have an entire litter of black kittens that are growing up in foster care simply because they haven't been adopted. They are about a year old now and cute as anything. They are sweet and wonderful and good with kids. We also have some of the older cats. One of them is Clarice. Clarice is a Siamese mix who was found in a home with 10 other cats. It is unknown if she lived there or was a stray as the house wasn't secured. She is 16 months old and working on people skills. She is good with dogs and cats, but prefers people at distance unless time for treats or at bedtime she will sleep with you. Isn't she beautiful? As always, all Solas animals are fully vetted and microchipped prior to adoption. If you want to help, Solas always needs volunteer fosters, or you can donate supplies through our Amazon wish list at tinyurl.com/solaslist or donate via PayPal at paypal.me/solaspetadoption. Contact info includes info@solaspetadoption.org or 402-577-0213 for more information. The article is concluded with a photo of the Siamese mix, Clarice. Forecast: warm today, temps begin to fall Monday. This story is headlined by members of the Sons of Union veterans of the Civil War making their way down South Main Street during the annual Veterans Day parade on Saturday, November 6, 2021. The float has 2 American flags on both the front and back, and a sign highlighting Sons of Union veterans of the Civil War. Today will be mostly sunny with a high of 69. It looks to be the last warmer day for a while. South winds may gust as high as 23 miles per hour at times throughout the day, according to the National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska. Tonight, temps drop into the 40s with clear skies. Monday will have a high of 60. Tuesday has a high of 58. Rain moves into the Council Bluffs, Omaha area on Wednesday and continues through Friday. Snow chances move in on Thursday night. Here is the upcoming forecast according to the Weather Service. Today, mostly sunny with a high near 69. South wind 8 to 15 miles per hour with gusts as high as 23 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low around 46. South wind 3 to 8 miles per hour. On Monday, today, mostly sunny with a high near 60. South-southeast winds around 6 miles per hour becoming east-northeast in the afternoon. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 44. And for Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high near 58. And Tuesday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 40. For Wednesday, a chance of rain mainly after 1 p.m. Cloudy with a high near 58. On Wednesday night, a chance of rain. Mostly cloudy with a low around 39. On Veterans Day, a chance of rain. Partly sunny with a high near 48. Thursday night, a slight chance of rain and snow, mostly cloudy with a low of around 31. And on Friday, a slight chance of rain and snow, mostly sunny with a high near 40. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 8th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Candace Carr from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. November is for giving, giving thanks, and giving back. This story is headlined by 10-year-old Isaiah Collars as he peruses the pumpkin pickings from the Honey Creek Stevens Family Gardens during the final installment of the 2021 Farmers Market Council Bluffs season on Thursday, September 30, 2021. The market ran every Thursday through the season and featured several area vendors, as well as live music, children's activities, and group activities each week. Farmers Market Council Bluffs is a program from the 712 Initiative, and the 2021 season was presented by CHI Health Mercy Council Bluffs. The Halloween trunks have closed and the treats are gobbled up. As the calendar flips to November, now is the time to pause before the rush of the holidays and be intentional about giving, both giving thanks and giving back. Council Bluffs and Southwest Iowa have much to be thankful for this season. Our community endured another year of COVID-19, and hardworking local nonprofits pushed to offer more services and programs than ever, enhancing and enriching the lives of our neighbors and ourselves. We can be thankful for the work of Habitat for Humanity of Council Bluffs, which recycled $248,000 worth of building materials through the Restore in 2020, which helps fund affordable housing. We can be proud of the work of the 712 Initiative, hosting over 40 farmers market vendors on Thursday nights with an average of over 600 guests per week. We can be grateful for All Care Health Center removing barriers to healthcare, offering over 500 free rides to community members without transportation. Giving Tuesday, a global day of giving, is coming up on November 30th. In Pottawatomie County, we call this day #GivingTuesday712. After Thanksgiving dishes are washed and cyber shopping carts are purchased, the Council Bluffs Metro will come together to give back to the organizations to whom we give thanks. Each of us can be counted among those who will do what is needed to ensure that vital organizations can continue strengthening our city through 2022 and beyond. On November 30th for #GivingTuesday712, Share Omaha and presenting sponsor TS Bank will champion multiple ways you can give to local nonprofits like Micah House and Historic General Dodge House, whether it is donating money, items, or your time. All ways of giving are incredibly valuable, but after 2 years of stress, local causes like New Visions Homeless Services especially need the flexibility of cash as they plan for the new year. For the past 2 years, Jointly, the Omaha / Council Bluffs Metro has doubled its giving on this day. In 2018, prior to an organized effort, our region raised about $500,000 together. In 2019, when Share Omaha launched hashtag GivingTuesday 402 and hashtag GivingTuesday 712, the metro raised $1.69 million. In 2020, our area took it even further, collectively giving $3.16 million. When you give a little bit, your neighbors give a little bit, and your friends give a little bit, and we can experience the power of taking action together. The story in the middle is followed by All Care Health Center's Jose Luavano, who has given rides to patients who would have otherwise had no way to get to their healthcare appointment. He is standing in front of the All Care van smiling for the work he has done for the past 15 years. Quote, "On Giving Tuesday, we're called to uplift and support the important work that's being done in our community," quote, said Amy Lilith Thorup, Development Director of Potawatomi Arts, Culture, and Entertainment, PACE. Quote, "No matter the size of the gift, we're reminded that small actions can make a huge impact on the local causes that matter to us most. For the second year, Potawatomi County Community Foundation will offer a 20% match on all donations to Iowa-based nonprofit endowments at the foundation during the month of November. In 2020, this bonus giving totaled over $70,000. This added benefit allows your hashtag GivingTuesday712 donation to organizations like Potawatomi Conservation Foundation, Hooves and Paws Rescue of the Heartland, and Family Inc. to do even more. Share Omaha's website connects givers in an 8-county region to easy ways to volunteer, donate, and provide items year-round and on Giving Tuesday. The one-step donation portal at shareomaha.org makes it easy to give causes that match your passions. Simply search nonprofits, make your selections, choose the amount you'd like to donate, and check out in a single transaction. Payments are facilitated by PayPal, but a PayPal account is not needed as givers can check out as a guest utilizing any major credit or debit card. As we start to plan the dishes for our Thanksgiving meals, may you take a moment to also plan your giving to nonprofits for whom we give thanks. And now for this week's Daily Nonpareil obituaries. Bernice Poles. Bernice Poles, age 81, passed away peacefully at Rising Sun Christian Village, November 3, 2021. She was born August 16, 1940, to Donovan and Dorothy Newland in Des Moines, Iowa. Bernice enjoyed reading, bowling, traveling, Nebraska football, and attending church. Her pride and joy was her family. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by husband Larry D. Poles, brother Bill Newland, sister-in-laws Virginia Newland and Mary Ann Engel. Bernice is survived by children Yvette Schenning, Carrie Powell, and Cole Poles, siblings Diana Brown, Evelyn Chapman, and Mark Newland, grandchildren Courtney, Chantel, Michaela, Theo, and Lucy, and great-grandchildren Trevor, Caleb, and Elijah, many family and friends. Memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Monday, November 8, 2021. The family will direct her memorials. John Church. John Church, 79, of Council Bluffs, Iowa, died Tuesday, November 2, 2021, at University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. John was born on December 23, 1941, in Correctionville, Iowa, the son of Floyd Ernest and L. Nadine Church. Floyd and Nadine met in Holstein, Iowa, and were married on June 21, 1934, in Sioux City, Iowa. John grew up with his older brother, Jerry, in Glendale, California, and Cherokee, Iowa, before the family settled in Atlantic, Iowa in 1948, when their dad took the position as meat market manager at Swanson's grocery store. It was said that John was a little ornery as a child. While in school, he was active in choir and musicals and played the clarinet. John had fond memories of working alongside his dad on Saturdays at the grocery store. He graduated from Atlantic High School with the class of 1960. Following graduation, he attended Buena Vista College in Storm Lake, Iowa, and received his bachelor degree in elementary education in 1964. John later continued his education, receiving his Master's in Elementary Administration in 1967 from Northeast Missouri State Teachers College, now Truman State University in Kirksville, Missouri. Little did John know that when he went to the weekly Wednesday night dance at the YMCA in Des Moines, Iowa, on the night of March 21, 1965, he would meet his future wife. On May 27, 1966, he and Susan Ann Vitalis were united in marriage at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Des Moines. They attended many dances throughout the years in Des Moines and Omaha, literally dancing through life. Susan will always treasure him as a wonderful husband. John began his teaching career in the Griswold Community School District at the Grant Building. He later served as principal at the Orrin Elementary School in Orrin, Iowa, but it was a short stint as he found himself better suited in the classroom. The family then moved to Marion, Iowa, and he took a position in the Cedar Rapids School District. Following the death of his father in 1970, the desire to be in the rolling hills of western Iowa called, and the family moved to Council Bluffs. John started teaching elementary education in the Council Bluffs Community School District, a majority of his time at Hoover, retiring in 1998 after bettering the minds of his students for 34 years. He had a natural professional demeanor and was a very traditional teacher, finding a great deal of importance in reciting the Pledge of Allegiance daily and sticking to the basics of the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. His love of learning not only led to guiding students, but also his own, researching genealogy for countless hours and reading any book he could get his hands on about history and historical figures. John's curiosity into this was even deeper due to him being a direct descendant of 10 passengers who arrived on the Mayflower in 1620. Among those ancestors were 7 signers of the Mayflower Compact, including Captain Miles Standish, who was his 8th great-grandfather. He and Susan were members of the General Society of Mayflower Descendants, John serving as captain at one time of the Iowa Society. John was a very practical person and liked to keep things as uncomplicated as possible. He was able to relish and find great joy in what the simple things in life offered him. He loved the doo-wop style of music and the music of Mario Lanza. John looked forward to picnics and cookouts with his family. John connected with his grandchildren by reading to them when they came to visit, and it is one of their treasured memories of their grandfather. Do you remember the sound of John's voice and his laugh? This was something he was known for, often hearing that he had a voice for radio because it was so rich in tone. His distinctive laugh would bring bountiful joy to a room. Through all that life dealt John, the good and the bad, he was sustained by his faith in his Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. John and Susan attended the New Horizon Presbyterian Church in Council Bluffs. John is survived by his wife of 55 years, Susan of Council Bluffs, Iowa, sons Peter, Church of Milan, Illinois, and Mark, Church of Council Bluffs, Iowa, grandchildren Adam Weston, Church of Hinesville, Georgia, and Amy Louise, Church of Brandon, Florida, and nieces Mary Elizabeth Stone and Stephanie Braun Church. He is preceded in death by his parents, Floyd and L. Nadine Church, and his brother, Jerry Church. Per John's wishes, no service will be held. A private family interment will be held at the Atlantic Cemetery in Atlantic, Iowa. Memorials may be directed to the New Horizon Presbyterian Church, 30 Valley View Drive, Council Bluffs, Iowa, 51503, or to a charity of your choice. Roland Funeral Service is caring for John's family and his arrangements. Condolence may be left at www.rolandfuneralservice.com. Those were Saturday, November 6th, obituaries. Now for Sunday, November 7th, obituaries. Barbara Zimmerman. Barbara Ann Zimmerman, age 79, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 3rd at Bethany Lutheran Home. Barb was born May 26, 1942, in Omaha, Nebraska, to the late Glenn and Angeline Tadlock. She attended Thomas Jefferson High School and was united in marriage to Gary J. Zimmerman on April 4, 1964. To this union, 3 boys were born, Anthony, Michael, and Timothy. Barb was a longtime member of Holy Family Catholic Church and worked for 10-plus years at United Credit Union as a loan processor. In addition to her parents, she is preceded in death by her infant brother, sisters Glenda Reynolds and Judy Anderson. Barb leaves behind her husband Gary of 57 years, sons and daughters-in-law Tony and Melinda of Keller, Texas, Mike and Christy of Omaha, Tim and Denise Slodgy of Bellevue, grandchildren Amanda, Zach, Hunter, and Haley Zimmerman, Dawson and Hannah Wills, Brandon Clapper, great-granddaughter Colette Zimmerman, sister Linda Potter and husband Bob of Omaha, nieces, nephews, and a cousin. Recitation of the Rosary Monday, 6 p.m., followed by visitation until 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Mass of Christian Burial is Tuesday, 10:30 a.m. at Corpus Christi Holy Family Church, located at 2217 Avenue B, followed by luncheon in the church social hall. Interment Wednesday at 11 a.m. at Omaha National Cemetery. Memorials can be sent to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. Mervyn Muller, age 95, passed away on November 4, 2021. He was born June 5, 1926, to Nicholas and Anna Muller in Howes, Nebraska. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by brother Dwayne Muller, nephew Terry Muller. Mervyn is survived by nephew Perry Muller, nieces Linda Krikemeyer, and Susie Muller Svoboda, great nieces and nephews Michael Muller, Morgan Muller, Matthew Muller, Megan Muller, Kurt Krikemeyer, Greg Krikemeyer, Eric Krikemeyer, Sean Krikemeyer, Nick Muller, and Amanda Kruger, and family and friends. Visitation will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Tuesday, November 9th, 2021. Funeral service will be held at 3 p.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Tuesday, November 9th, 2021. The family will direct memorials. Roger Kaiser. Roger Lee Kaiser, age 69, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 4th at CHI Mercy Hospital. Roger was born October 20th, 1952, in Williamsport, Indiana, to the late Loy and Ava Kaiser and attended school there. He was united in marriage to Elodie Carlson on August 24th, 1974. Roger worked for over 20 years at Wick's Truck Trailers and was affiliated at Broadway United Methodist Church. He loved racing of all kinds, drove stock cars, Harley-Davidson, and was a devoted family man. He is preceded in death by his parents, Ava and Pickles, brothers Joe and Ronnie Kaiser. Roger leaves behind his wife, Elodie, of 47 years, daughters Lindsay Kaiser of Council Bluffs, Allison Knudsen of Glenwood, Iowa, son Andy Kaiser of Omaha, two grandchildren, Lexi and Hadley, and a grandson to be born shortly, sisters Vicky Kaiser, Gretchen, Beck, all of Illinois, nieces and nephews. His visitation is Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. The celebration of Roger's life, Wednesday at 11 a.m., all at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Reverend Alexis Johnson will be the officiant. Interment in Walnut Hill Cemetery is followed by luncheon at the Walnut Hill Reception Center. His family will direct memorials. Eric Scott Jacobson. Eric Scott Jacobson, September 24, 1980 to November 7, 2009. 12 years ago today, Eric, we received a phone call that no parent ever wants. You were gone. Not a day goes by that you aren't thought of, and we will always remember what a wonderful life you had. Thanks for those beautiful memories, kiddo. Love and miss you, forever and always, Mom, Dad, and family. And that concludes this weekend's Daily Nonpareil Obituaries. Twins hire former Padres manager Tingler as bench coach. This story is headlined by former San Diego Padres manager Jace Tingler looking from the dugout before a baseball game against the Miami Marlins from Thursday, July 22, 2021 in Miami. He is in San Diego's iconic colors with his hands in his front pockets. Out of Minneapolis, the Associated Press reports, former San Diego Padres manager Jace Tingler was hired Monday as bench coach of the Minnesota Twins, who also picked David Popkins as their new hitting coach. Tingler went 116-106 over two seasons with the Padres, who made the playoffs in 2020 but collapsed down the stretch this year, resulting in his dismissal. Prior to his time in San Diego, Tingler spent 13 seasons in a variety of roles with the Texas Rangers. The 40-year-old Tingler was drafted as an outfielder by the Toronto Blue Jays in 2003 and played parts of four seasons in the minor leagues before turning to coaching. The 31-year-old Popkins was the hitting coach for the Class A Great Lakes Loons in 2021, a Los Angeles Dodgers affiliate. Popkins played three minor league seasons as an outfielder in the St. Louis Cardinals system and 3 years of independent league ball before going into coaching. Tingler fills the void left when Mike Bell died of cancer in March. Popkins replaces Edgar Varela, who is reassigned to a minor league role. Rough weekend for NFL teams atop the standings. First place teams had a rough Sunday. Dak Prescott returned to the lineup for Dallas, who were 6-2, and the Cowboys didn't score until Denver led 30-0 in the fourth quarter on the road. Josh Allen had three turnovers, and the Buffalo Bills, 5-3, showed no discipline in an embarrassing 9-6 loss at woeful Jacksonville. Without Aaron Rodgers, the Green Bay Packers, 7-2, couldn't muster enough offense to upend Kansas City in rookie Jordan Love's first start. Coming off an emotional week, the Las Vegas Raiders, who were 5-2, struggled in a 23-16 loss at the Giants. Other winning teams had a tough day at home. The Saints, who were 5-3, lost to Atlanta in their first game, missing Jameis Winston. The Rams, who were 7-2, were routed by the AFC South leading Titans, who won their first game since losing Derrick Henry. The Bengals, who were 5-4, were blown out by the Browns for their second straight loss after a 5-2 start. A couple of winning teams struggled to get their victories. The Ravens, who were 6-2, needed overtime to handle the Vikings. The Chargers, who were 5-3, beat Philadelphia on a late field goal. Overall, division leaders were 3-4, and home teams were 5-7. Three clubs favored to win by 7 or more points lost outright. Week 9 will serve as a prime example for any coach who wants to issue the, quote, any given Sunday warning to his players before a game. Of course, they've heard it before. Quote, "It's hard to win football games no matter who you play," Allen said. "We're all grown men. We all get paid to play this game. They came out. They wanted it more." The Bills are an enigma. They were the odds-on favorite to win the Super Bowl, but couldn't beat a team that had lost 21 of its last 23 games. Their high-powered offense hasn't been sharp in consecutive games, including last week's victory over Miami. Buffalo's loss coupled with Tennessee's win and a loss to the Titans, who were 7-2 last month, means the Bills have an uphill battle to get to the number one seed in the AFC. They have to hold off New England, 5-4, just to win the AFC East. The Cowboys had won 6 in a row before the inconsistent Broncos dominated them. Quote, "The message is don't take the cheese, and frankly, we were outcoached. We were outplayed all the way through." Dallas coach Mike McCarthy said, "This is the first time I felt clearly our energy didn't exceed our opponent. That's disappointing." Heading into the second half, the conference races are wide open. The Titans are the AFC's frontrunner following their convincing win on the road against Los Angeles, but they still have to play without Henry for the long haul. Baltimore has overcome a slew of injuries to lead the AFC North. The Ravens have a difficult schedule over the final 9 after road games at Miami and Chicago. The Bills still may have the most talented roster despite their recent struggles. The Chargers, Browns, Raiders, and Chiefs also have a shot to be there in late January. Arizona, their record being 8-1, leads the NFC race, but the Cardinals already lost at home to the Packers with Rodgers. Tom Brady and the defending Super Bowl champion Buccaneers, who are 6-2, had a productive bye, seeing three teams ahead of them lose. And the Cowboys and Rams will bounce back after a loss. This surely won't be the last topsy-turvy weekend in the NFL season. Larson wraps up comeback season with first NASCAR title. Out of Avondale, Arizona, the AP reports, Kyle Larson won. No surprise, right? He was, after all, the overwhelming 2-1 betting favorite to win NASCAR's season-ending championship race. Suspended nearly all of last season for using a racial slur, Larson closed his comeback season in NASCAR with his first championship by with a title-winning victory at Phoenix Raceway. Larson was in tears during his cool-down laps as he reflected on his rebuild from out-of-work NASCAR driver to Cup champion. Quote, 18 months ago, I didn't even think I'd be in a Cup car again. Strapping for the Daytona 500 didn't even seem real, let alone winning the championship, Larson said. Quote, it's definitely been a journey, a roller coaster. I'm very thankful for my second chance and every opportunity I've been given in these last 18 months. Life's a crazy thing. Just stay positive through it. Larson led 7 times for a race-high 108 laps, but was running 4th, last among the title contenders as teammates Martin Truex Jr. and Denny Hamlin controlled the championship late in a pair of Toyotas. Then, a caution reset everything. Because he won the pole Saturday in qualifying, Larson had the first stall on pit road and the shortest sprint onto the track of the 4 title contenders. He silently prayed for a flawless service call from his Hendrick Motorsports crew to get the number 5 Chevrolet back on the track ahead of his 3 title rivals. Wow, did the number 5 team deliver. Larson's crew performed its second fastest stop of the season, a span that stretches 38 races, and Larson went from last among the final 4 to first. Quote, I knew the only way we were going to pull it off is our pit crew got us off as a leader, and damn, they did. That was just crazy, Larson said. Quote, those guys nailed the pit stop. Larson controlled the restart with 25 laps remaining, quickly cleared Truex, then held off several of Truex's challenges. There was no stopping Larson, just as he had been impossible to stop all season, as he drove to his 10th Cup victory of the year. He beat Truex to the finish line by an easy 0.398 seconds. Quote, there were so many points in this race where I did not think we were going to win, Larson said. Quote, without my pit crew on that last stop, we were not to be standing right here. They are the true winners of this race. They are true champions. Quote, I'm just blessed to be part of this group. Every single man or person, man and woman, at Hendrick Motorsports, this win is for all of us and every one of you. This is unbelievable. I'm speechless. Truex, the 2017 champion, finished 2nd and was followed by Hamlin, his Joe Gibbs racing teammate. Hamlin is 0-5 in championship finales and was the only driver among the final 4 contenders who did not lead a lap on Sunday. Truex has finished 2nd in the championship standings 3 times in the 4 seasons since his 2017 title. Quote, ultimately, we needed to beat him off pit road. It's unfortunate, but we win and lose as a team, Truex said. Quote, that's 3 times we've been 2nd, and that sucks. 2nd hurts, I'm not gonna lie, especially with the car we had and the job the guys did. Hamlin, who raced Larson all season for the regular season title that ultimately went to Larson, has firmly maintained that Larson should be the champion. But it didn't soften the blow of another title defeat for the 3-time Daytona 500 winner. Quote, anytime you can win 10 races in a year, you're absolutely a deserving champion, Hamlin said. Quote, they did a great job on the last pit stop and got him out there, and he just set sail after that. Proud of my team. Just a really good year. A really, really good year. And things just didn't pan out. Chase Elliott, the reigning champion and NASCAR's most popular driver, led 94 laps but finished 4th. Quote, I was really proud of our group. I thought we brought a really good car, just didn't work out, Elliott said. But look proud of our team. A lot to build on, and also congrats to Kyle. Very, very deserving champions, and glad to see Kyle have success. Quote, when you're a good driver and a good person, and you only surround yourself with good people, success is warranted. It's good to see that. Larson seemed to have tears in his eyes on his cool-down lap as he celebrated a career-defining moment he wasn't sure what happened last year. He was fired 4 races into the season and lost nearly every sponsor for his use of a racial slur while racing online. And Larson retreated to his sprint car roots to rebuild his life. He volunteered for multiple different grassroots organizations as Larson went on a personal journey to learn more about himself as well as social justice issues. It was Rick Hendrick who decided to give him another chance and hired Larson once NASCAR lifted his suspension. Larson watched last year's championship race from the competition compound on the Hendrick Motorsports campus in North Carolina. A year later, he gave Hendrick its 14th Cup title. I never thought I was taking a risk. I know how good he is. I'm just fortunate we were able to get him, and man, what a wheelman he is, Hendrick said. Quote, 10 races won, 11 with the All-Star race. It's unbelievable. Larson won 5 of the 10 playoff races and tied Tony Stewart in 2011 for most wins in a single playoff season. He also broke Jeff Gordon's 20-year record of most laps led in a single season. The 29-year-old from Elk Grove, California, joins Gordon, Kevin Harvick, and Jimmy Johnson as champions from the Golden State. It was the 280th victory for Hendrick Motorsports, which moved past Petty Enterprises in May with Larson behind the wheel as NASCAR's winningest team. The team has won 14 championships in 27 years. Cliff Daniels, who took over as crew chief for 7-time champion Johnson 22 races in the 2019 season, won his first championship. Daniels spent 58 races running the number 48 team for Johnson, and they closed their run together with a 5th-place finish in last year's season finale as Johnson crossed the finish line behind the 4 title contenders. Daniel and his crew welcomed in Larson the next week, won 10 points races and the $1 million All-Star race and now the Cup title. The win by Larson halted Toyota's bid to sweep championship weekend. Toyota drivers won the Truck and Xfinity Series titles to the open weekend, but Larson gave Chevrolet the biggest trophy of them all. Chevrolet had already clinched the manufacturer's titles in Cup and Xfinity before the weekend.